This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we'll learn all you need to know about HPV, the human papillomavirus, and its role in cervical cancer, plus what hospice has to offer at the end of life. But first, some breakthrough research in prostate cancer. Other than skin cancer, prostate cancer is the most common cancer in American men. And the American Cancer Society estimates that in 2013 alone, more than 230,000 new cases of prostate cancer will be diagnosed, and almost 30,000 men will die from the disease. But how do you know if you will be among the unlucky group for which the disease will be fatal? Well, that's where prostate cancer research comes in. And Dr. Leszek Kutula is an associate professor of urology and of biochemistry and molecular biology at Upstate Medical University, who is studying prostate cancer to help us find the answers. Welcome, Dr. Kutula. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here.
So right now, if you are diagnosed with prostate cancer, and I understand that 1 in 6 men in the United States will be diagnosed with it at some point in their lives, what tools do we currently have to analyze the aggressiveness of the disease and whether or not it'll be life-threatening?
The key tool to detect prostate cancer and in its invasiveness is histopathology. And
Which means
that basically take biopsy from prostate tissue and we analyze it for invasiveness.
So you can take a biopsy from the prostate, do an analysis of it, and you can tell if that particular cell type is aggressive at this point?
Yes, but we cannot tell when in early stages of prostate cancer which tumors will progress to become invasive. And then this is the point when my research comes in.
Yeah, because I know that there's been so much controversy in the last few years about whether to treat, how to treat, how aggressively to treat, given the numbers of people diagnosed with prostate cancer these days.
Yes, so there is a problem of over-treatment of prostate cancer because we don't know how to tell, when to tell that this particular non-invasive cancer will become invasive. Then people get scared with this diagnosis of prostate cancer and basically decide to be treated very early. So our tools are not good enough to tell when the prostate cancer becomes invasive.
So as you said, that's why you're engaged in research to help us figure this out.
Yes, I'm interested in the in finding out what is the molecular basis of prostate cancer progression. So I want to define the markers or mechanism when to tell when the prostate cancer becomes invasive and will affect people tremendously.
So that's your mission, to determine how these cells, which are the most aggressive, or how they change or why they change and whether they will change.
That's exactly right, yes.
So what currently, let me just ask you this to follow up on that. If you do find that, how will that impact the clinical approach to prostate cancer?
Oh, this is actually a very important question, very important problem that many funding agencies are focusing on finding the markers of invasiveness of prostate cancer. So National Institute of Health, Department of Defense, and Prostate Cancer Foundation are supporting this kind of research very much. And my research is focused on, it took several years to develop. And initially, I was not interested in prostate cancer. My research came from studying genetics of a specific gene. And I found a link to prostate cancer, that
really?
This gene might regulate prostate cancer progression.
So you were looking at genes and found a gene that you think responsible?
It might be one of the genes that is responsible for controlling prostate cancer progression. And so initially I cloned the gene called ABI1. And then by genetic link, I found that this gene is quite frequently lost in primary tumors, prostate tumors. And then I made a conditional knockout mouse model.
So what does that mean, a knockout mouse model? The gene is taken out of a mouse?
Oh, so basically, we modify sequences in the mouse and to disrupt its function.
So you change the genetic makeup of the mouse?
Basically, we change the genetic makeup of the mouse, and basically we can follow whether this mouse develops prostatic adenocarcinoma.
Whether it gets prostate cancer.
Exactly.
So, and what did you find?
So we found that this particular gene regulates prostate cancer progression in the mouse, and we have great hopes for these studies. We recently received a grant from National Institute of Health on the subject, and I was previously funded by Department of Defense. And I came here to Upstate recently to join the Department of Urology and with the vision of Gennady Bratsvavsky, who is running great clinical operation, but with the vision that research is very important for translational medicine. And that's why we are collaborating on testing what we find in the mouse in the clinic so we can apply those findings.
So what you're really saying, and that's the true goal of translational research, is this idea of bench, meaning in the lab, to bedside care.
Exactly.
And you're saying that since you found that this particular genetic, it's called ABI1,
yes,
can affect the progression of cancer or the growth of tumor, that you can then literally affect or develop some kind of what? Vaccines? What types of things would you be...
Well,
how would it translate?
Yes, so first we will define the changes in the mouse, and then we translate these changes. We test whether this exactly the same changes happen in human patients. So in the mouse, we can also test various drugs, whether they stop progression. And basically, the gene could be a target for drug development.
So you use the mouse as the guinea pig.
Yes, exactly.
The mouse becomes the guinea pig. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Leszek Kotula. He's an Upstate cancer researcher, and we're talking about his research about prostate cancer. Well, this is very hopeful and interesting information.
Yeah, I'm passionate about the research, and I think that this will help patients. This type of research will help patients eventually, both in diagnostic strategies as well as treatment strategies.
Can I ask you, this is something that's always been on my mind of late. Since the sequester in Washington and the cutback of some of the NIH grants, you obviously have not been adversely affected at this point. You're still getting grant monies.
Well, I was very lucky. Lots of people who have very, very good grants and very good research couldn't receive money because of the situation. So the whole research community is very much affected by the sequestration, unfortunately. And it's very sad because there is an enormous amount of very good research, excellent research going on. And with the sequestration, some research cannot be done. And ultimately, we're all doing the research to help patients.
Yeah, and it sounds like it could set us back in terms of...
Oh, definitely. It could set
us back for decades even,
exactly,
in terms of people's, the continuity of their work. Well, getting back to your work, help us understand a little bit more specifically what kinds of... When you talk about drugs, are you talking about drugs that would... You said first diagnosis as well as treatment.
Yes.
Are there ways to use this knowledge of the genetic makeup or the genetic regulation of the tumor to actually help with the diagnosis?
So it comes down to levels of specific molecules in the prostate. And sometimes there is not enough of a specific molecule. Sometimes there's too much of a specific molecule.
And so either one can cause a cancer?
Exactly.
Really?
Yes. And what happens that with drugs, we can control sometimes the levels of these molecules, and we can bring them up or lower them down.
Wow.
And the strategies basically come down to that we test this in a mouse model, for example, or in tissue culture. And we use these strategies then to test them on patients. Now, the the interesting thing about the mouse model is, or very important thing about mouse models is that you can screen many different compounds at the same time.
Really?
Well, because there is there are so many just so many patients that take up in clinical trials, that participate in clinical trials. So sometimes some compounds cannot be tested. Because
so you're saying you have enough because you have so many mice?
Exactly.
Because mice can be replicating so quickly.
Yes.
You have a lot more material to work
yes,
with,
yes.
So to speak. Are you at the point at this point of going to a clinical trial with this stuff, or are you still staying in the mouse model?
We're still staying in the mouse model. We hope that in a couple of years we can be at that point.
That's very, very exciting. One question I have is, how similar is a mouse model to a human, though? I mean, obviously, on the evolutionary chain or on the biological chain, they're very far apart. So how?
There are some anatomical differences between human and mouse prostate. However, there are some very important similarities.
Really?
For example, androgen sensitivity is the same. It's also mouse.
That's the male hormone androgens.
Yes, exactly. That is very important for controlling the prostate tissue growth. So because of the similarities, we can use the mouse models for the studies. And importantly also, prostate changes do not occur spontaneously in the mouse. Prostate cancer does not occur. So you're saying
in the natural world, a mouse will not develop prostate cancer?
Yes.
So what does that tell you?
It means that we can modify the genes in a clean background. We can modify the genes and model the gene function in the mouse and understand the physiological processes in the mouse.
To make them more like the human, in a sense? Or to make them develop cancer?
To make them develop cancer. And then we don't have to worry about the background. I mean, we do not get, the mice do not get prostate cancer normally, naturally.
So basically what you're saying is, once you understand how you can induce cancer, how you can control the growth of the tumors, how you can, what mechanisms or what numbers or amounts of molecular material
yes.
is necessary, you then can really trial this in humans and actually eliminate tumor growth, or can you prevent the development of prostate cancer?
The goal of all prostate cancer research is to eliminate, to cure prostate cancer. So... I believe it's an achievable goal. The time frame is difficult because it also depends on the funding
continued
funding. However, I believe that strongly that one day we can control the prostate cancer.
Control and perhaps even eliminate it,
exactly.
as you're saying.
Yes.
Well, this is fascinating. And I understand that you're hoping that you currently have a lab outside of what will be our new cancer center. But at some point, the hope will be that the research will be located alongside the clinical, obviously allowing for a lot more dialogue.
That's the best setting. That's the best setting when you are next to the clinician and Gennady Bratsvavsky, who runs the urology, Department of Urology here at Upstate, has this vision. That's why I joined this department.
Well, we're so glad you're here, and we're so grateful for the research you're doing. It's fabulous. My guest has been Dr. Leszek Kutula. He's an associate professor of urology and of biochemistry and molecular biology at Upstate Medical University. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
I'm Linda Cohen, and this is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Coming up, what you need to know about cervical cancer and HPV, the human papillomavirus. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. Human papillomavirus, or HPV, is the most common sexually transmitted disease in the world. Almost 80% of the world's population is exposed to it by the age of 50. And while it can cause several different kinds of cancer, there is no known cure. Well, joining us with more on this is Heather Shannon, the Director of Upstate Midwifery and Gynecology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you, Linda.
Thanks for coming in. So HPV, the human papillomavirus, is quite prevalent worldwide as well as in this country and can cause cancer. Well, tell us about it. What kinds of cancer can it cause?
Well, the biggest cancer concern is cervical cancer. HPV is known to cause 99.7% of all cervical cancers that women may experience or have. Besides cervical cancer, there is a great uptick in oral throat cancer, tongue cancer, and that is anywhere from 12% for the throat cancer and up, because we're starting to notice those numbers are starting to creep up. Also, there's anal cancer as well as vulvar and penile cancers. And it's about 40% of all penile cancers that are caused by HPV and 90% of all anal cancers.
Wow, so that really does affect, I guess it affects the genital area and anal area, cervical area, oropharyngeal. It's really widespread in that sense. Well, how common is it? I mean, I read somewhere that 79 million Americans are currently infected. And it says that it's so common that nearly all sexually active men and women will have at least one type of HPV at some point in their lives. But what is there? Is there more than one type of HPV?
Oh, there's over 100 types of HPV, and researchers are finding more and more new strains. So we're getting smarter with the types and the kinds of HPV viruses that are out there.
So there are more than 40, for example?
Well, there's more than 100 in general. For genital cancers, there is between 30 and 40 HPV viral viruses out there.
But are some more high risk for cancer as opposed to others?
Yes. There's like 15 to 20 that are specifically found for the cervical cancer and vulvar cancer. Specifically, the HPV type 16 and 18 have been found in majority. Like HPV 16 is 54% of cervical cancers.
So they have identified which ones are really more high risk.
That are more high risk. And then the low risk are the ones who that can cause warts.
Genital
warts, as well as the warts on your fingers and the little warts that children get. HPV is linked to that. However, we need to be clear, those are not sexually transmitted for little children.
Right. Well, how do you know if you have it? I mean, you might notice you have warts. That's something pretty obvious. But other than that, I read somewhere that most of the symptoms are often silent. And in some cases, the virus seems to go away and doesn't really lead to any health problems. So how do you know?
Correct. Unfortunately for us, we don't have symptoms like vaginal discharge or an actual sore. And the only way we can really find out is through a pap smear or an actual HPV culture.
So tell us about that. What about screening to know if you have it?
Recently, ACOG, American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, as well as the American Cancer Society and American Colposcopy Society, ASCCP, had changed the recommendations for screening for pap smears. We used to get pap smears when we were in our teens. They now say that's not important because we know 99.7% of the cancers are through HPV virus, that if we screen under the age of 21, you will not pick up the cancer. You will not pick up the abnormality because this is a slow-growing cancer. So they recommend pap smears after the age of 21, and we can stop at the age of 65.
But is the screening for the cancer or for the existence of the HPV?
It's for the abnormality changes to your cervix. So that means that when you have a pap smear coming back abnormal, we have already asked the lab to do an HPV analysis to see if it's HPV positive. So when you have your pap smear and you have a result that says it's normal, that means you do not have an active HPV infection. It also means if it comes back abnormal, that if the HPV is present, that we need to take further steps to evaluate whether you have cancer or you are heading towards cancer.
So is there any way at this point to know which people who are infected with HPV will go on to develop cancer.
No, you can't. You can't determine that by looking at a person or through someone's history. Obviously, it's important for us to be as healthy as possible and our immune system to not be compromised, and also to be a non-smoker because smoking interferes with our immune system. And HPV can be cleared from our body in most cases, except there are a small number, about 10%, who do go on to further advanced cervical abnormality that could lead to cancer.
So the point is, people... It's endemic. Many people have HPV in their system, but don't necessarily go on to develop the cancer.
Correct.
It's a smaller percentage
Correct.
That do.
Correct. And the only way you will know if you have HPV is to do an HPV DNA culture. That's the only way you'll know.
So let's get very clear. How is it that HPV is transmitted?
It is transmitted
through this type of HPV.
This type of HPV, we're called the high-risk HPV, is transmitted through sexual contact.
So that
only. So that means you have to be exposed to HPV from someone else through sexual contact. And it could be oral, it could be anal, and it could be from sex toys as well, the sharing of sex toys.
So it also doesn't matter, therefore, if it's heterosexual or homosexual.
It's not specific to...
It's sexual engagement.
Sexual engagement, correct.
Right. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen. I'm here with Heather Shannon, and we're talking about HPV, the human papillomavirus, and its relationship to cancer. So I understand right now there is no cure for it. The only way to deal with it, in fact, is prevention, or the best way, not the only way. We'll get to treatment after. But the fact is there is no cure, so we're hoping that people pay attention to this whole notion of prevention. Tell us about prevention.
Prevention. We've got some good companies that have developed a vaccine. There's the Gardasil vaccine and the Cerevax. There's two types. And they are now recommended by the pediatricians to give to our girls that are as young as 9, as well as to boys.
And that's a recent addition to the recommendation, isn't
it? Within the last 5 years or so. So this vaccine is... proven to reduce the risks of certain types of HPV strains for development of cervical cancer. And the specific one is HPV 18, 16, that can, as well as 18, that can cause cervical cancer, that these vaccines will help boost the immune system in our younger girls.
So they've targeted HPV 16 and 18, though the ones which you mentioned before are most likely responsible for going on to develop cancer.
Correct. Approximately 70% of the cancers, yes.
And I read somewhere there are some new ones in the pipeline. Do you know much about those?
They're always developing new vaccines. It's needed because there's multiple strains, like I said, up to 40 strains of HPV that can cause cancer. So they continue to develop the technology.
So the concept really here is to catch it before. If everyone can be exposed and it's so prevalent, that the idea is to boost your immune system prior to sexual engagement, meaning at an age where you're not yet sexually active.
Correct.
But I think that what I've been reading is that the vaccines are underutilized. Let's talk about that. Why do you think that is, or what seem to be the stumbling blocks there?
Well, we've got a society that wants to protect our children from feeling that sex is okay. And if we give this immunizations, there are some parents that feel that this is giving their child permission to have sex.
Prematurely.
Prematurely,
so to speak.
Exactly. And also not be protective of their body and have maybe unprotected sex. Even though this HPV vaccine may help protect from cervical cancers or penile cancers, it's not going to protect from your other sexually transmitted diseases.
So that's a very important point. But is there any evidence that increases sexual promiscuity?
There is not evidence. I think it's more of an emotional feeling.
Do you think also what plays a role is people's general, of late, general suspicion with regard to vaccination in general?
Well, there's a lot of concern, especially with the autism scare years ago with our immunizations. So I do think that we're more cautious as parents of what vaccines are truly necessary. And of course, I think a lot of us feel that, well, our child will not have cervical cancer or end up with anal or penile cancer.
So I understand that right now the New York State rate of vaccination is quite low. Are they doing anything to try to boost this?
I think their most primary goal is to provide the education and information to the parents, to the families, to let them know that this is an important decision that they need to make for their child's future.
Is there anything that you know of that's going on in terms of education? Because it sounds to me like education both in schools and at home, primarily at home, because I think these kinds of conversations really need to take place at home. In your experience, in your professional experience, is that kind of thing happening more and more?
I don't think there's a lot that's more and more in the schools. I had actually offered my services to provide education to middle school students regarding these type of issues, and it wasn't jumped on. They feel they have a good health program to discuss sexual health with.
And do you think they're doing a decent job of that kind of thing?
From a parent's standpoint, with my own children, I feel that it could be stronger. I think it could be better. I understand that there's the age of, if we put the power of suggestion in a child, that maybe they're going to go out and have sex in middle school. But I don't think that's, I think if...
It seems to be that's where the rub lies, though.
Yes,
I mean, we've
correct.
Got on both sides of the argument, we say, if you talk about it too early, and it's been the big argument against sex education in general, that maybe they'll be more curious and they'll more be likely to engage. But the reality is, despite all that, whether it's media or whether it's just the world we live in, kids are engaging in sex a lot younger. So with that in mind, I'm on my soapbox here, but we need to protect them with education and knowledge. And with vaccination in this case.
That's correct. And I actually have a statistic right here from the CDC that talks about sixth graders who've had sex is 8.6%. And more than three partners is greater than 4.3% of sixth graders that have initiated sex. So this is important.
That's a dramatic fact.
It is a dramatic fact. And this is from the CDC. We do need to talk about it, and there's a way we can present this information that will be accepted by these children in schools.
I don't want to run out of time. In the little bit of time we have left, does it make sense for a person above the ages of recommended ages to get a vaccine, an HPV vaccine?
Knowing that 99.7% of our cervical cancers come from HPV, we could stop cervical cancer.
In its tracks. If all women, then, are you saying, to what are the age ranges that you would say it's worthwhile?
The recommendations now is age 9 to 26 to receive the HPV vaccine.
Great. So knowledge is power. And if you want to know more about all of this whole notion of annual screenings, you can contact Heather at 315-492-5875 to set up an appointment. My guest has been Heather Shannon, the director of Upstate Midwifery and Gynecology at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
I'm registered dietitian Terry Podolak with Healthy Eats, and this week we are talking about the benefits of including cranberries in your menus. First, I'd like to share that cranberries are one of the fruits native to North America. They are grown in fruit beds called bogs and are harvested in the fall by flooding the fruit beds. Then the floating fruit is gathered. The nutritional benefits are many, and as always, the least processed, the better. You can find cranberry supplements on store shelves, but the actual berry is a much better choice. Cranberries contain an antioxidant that helps prevent bacteria from sticking to the sides of the urinary tract, so cranberries are recommended to prevent urinary tract infections. Studies have not shown, though, that cranberries are an effective treatment once you have a urinary tract infection, so it's important if you feel you have an infection to see your doctor for the correct treatment. Emerging studies also show that cranberries help inhibit harmful bacteria associated with gum disease, slowing the buildup of dental plaque, and they're also associated with inhibiting H. pylori bacteria, and that bacteria is associated with stomach ulcers. Cranberries are a great source of fiber and vitamin C. You may be thinking cranberries, though, are too tart, but here are some suggestions to add cranberries to your diet. Try combining unsweetened cranberry juice in equal parts with your favorite fruit juice and sparkling mineral water for a light and refreshing spritzer. Garnish with a slice of lime. Cranberry juices on the shelves are often sweetened with high fructose corn syrup, which causes the juice to be much higher in calories. For variety, use dried cranberries instead of raisins in your recipes. Sprinkle a handful of dried cranberries over a bowl of oatmeal or your favorite cereal. Mix dried cranberries with lightly roasted nuts for a delicious snack. Toss your greens with a little olive oil and then add color with raw or dried cranberries. Add a little honey or maple syrup to chopped fresh cranberries or mix with your favorite fruit such as pineapple to balance the tartness. Adding cranberries is a great way to meet a recommendation of 3 servings of fruit per day. This has been Terry Podolak reminding you to eat healthy.
Next up, what hospice has to offer at the end of life. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
I am Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for December 16th. Tune in and tone up. Make most of TV time by adding exercise. Use weights and resistance bands while watching or go off the couch during commercials for cardiac activities like running in place and jumping jacks. Even if you only watch a few shows a week, you'll be adding a good bit of exercise to your routine. Try a workout routine during your favorite shows this week. You can even choose different routines for different shows or use each commercial break to try and beat your last record. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. There are difficult decisions and conversations that must take place surrounding the end of life, and few organizations are as well-versed and prepared to help with these as hospice. And here with more on just how hospice can help are Dr. Judy Setla, the medical director, and Bill Fole, the communications officer for Hospice of Central New York. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
So let's begin. Dr. Setla, give us a brief overview of hospice. What is it? What's your mission?
Hospice is part of the larger umbrella of palliative medicine that's been expanding in this country and across the world, that focuses on the reduction of suffering of patients, both with life-limiting illness and also when they face serious illness, say acute trauma. So hospice has its origins back several decades, back in Britain with Cicely Saunders, who found there was a great need to reduce the suffering and provide attention for those that were dying to relieve their symptoms. And she founded the first modern hospice, which not involved only the care of dying patients, but also studied how to relieve pain, opioid management. It taught medical students how to care for dying patients and did research. And those were the origins back in the 60s and 70s, and the concept crossed the Atlantic to the U.S., and in 1984, the legislature passed laws that allowed Medicare to pay for hospice services. And so our mission is to provide excellent holistic care to relieve the suffering at primarily end of life.
And when you say end of life, is there a time frame that you would include? In other words, are we talking about people in the last week of life, the last 6 months of life? Do you have any kind of time frame that you address?
In this country, because even in the 80s, there were concerns about cost of medicine. In this country, formal hospice care is intended for those with a prognosis of 6 months or less. And originally, hospices were modeled after care of cancer patients. Nowhere else in the world do they restrict hospice care by a time frame, but that is what we work with here. In the last 30 years, however, we now deal with end-of-life issues in a significant number of non-cancer conditions like end-stage heart disease, emphysema, multiple strokes, Lou Gehrig's disease, which makes makes it difficult to decide prognosis in those cases. And so hospice is designed for people in their last months of life. That can sometimes be difficult to tell.
I know historically, even as far back as the 11th century, there were these places that were set up to help people who were in pain, suffering, and dying. And at that time, they were separate entities. Now hospice focuses more on home, on the home, doesn't it? Tell us more about that.
Yes. A lot of people believe hospices are always places, when in fact, hospice programs are designed to deliver a set of services where a person lives. And here in Onondaga County, about three-quarters of our patients are cared for directly in their homes. And all of the services, all of the people, all of the visits, the medical supplies, the medications are delivered to these people's homes. And in fact, part of my week is spent driving to people's homes to do consults for difficult symptom management issues. And we do also care for people in nursing facilities across Onondaga County. And so the idea is that we provide a set of services to where a person lives. We are not necessarily a place.
And there is one longtime partner I know that is a place here in the Syracuse area, and that is Francis House.
That's Francis House, yes.
Tell us a little bit about what that is.
Francis House is a 16-bed facility not far from the hospice offices who provides the home for terminally ill patients, and we have partnered with them very successfully for many years. We provide the medical oversight, some of the staffing, the medications, just as we do in homes, and they provide the facility, the home for the patient.
And that's in the case where the person probably can't remain at home.
That's
correct. At the very end.
That's right.
Bill, in addition to all of these things, caring for the individual who's suffering, hospice does something more. It does some support of the caregiver. Tell us about that.
Caregiver and the entire family, as a matter of fact. And I think that's what really separates hospice palliative services from other services out there, is that we also, of course, focus on the patient, but we also take a lot of effort and care to make sure that primary caregiver is given the educational tools they need to know what's happening and what's going on and what they can expect. Also for the family, it's a real crisis period for a family when someone's terminally ill. And many times children, young people in that family are kind of put to the side because everyone's focused on that terminally ill patient. We can come in with grief counselors, with social workers, to help the family get through this process.
And you also have a program for children who have lost loved ones?
A number of them. During the school year, we have a teen group that meets weekly. Also, an elementary school aged group that meets weekly, too, at hospice on 7th North Street. And then during the summer, we have a one-week day camp for children who are having troubles coping with grief, and it's been very successful for the past 10 years now.
Mm-hmm. Judy, you have a team, though. This isn't just a single doctor or a single nurse. Tell us about the team approach.
Hospice is predicated on the fact that suffering comes in many forms. And in fact, this is some of the work of Cicely Saunders, and that suffering can have physical, psychological, emotional, social, and spiritual components to it. And therefore, no single person could address all of those things. And so in hospice and the larger field of palliative medicine, there is great emphasis on use of an interdisciplinary team of social workers, chaplains, nurses, physicians, and volunteers to address the needs of the patient and the caregiver and the whole family. And many of these are optional. People do not have to have volunteers or see a chaplain if they're not interested, but they are available if they need those services at any time.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Judy Setla and Bill Fole, both from Hospice of Central New York, and we're talking about the mission of hospice. But I also know that there's a very important other role for hospice, and that's in helping families engage in conversations about their end-of-life choices. How do you best, Bill, how do you best assist folks
depends
in that
on the
regard?
Depends on the patient, depends on the family, but talking about end-of-life care early on is just now we're starting to see benefits of it. There's been numerous studies in the last 2 or 3 years that show that because of reduced stress levels within that family, because there is a plan in place, that patients are living longer in some cases. People are having a better time of it because of the less stress involved. Caregivers are not wondering what, you know, grandma or grandpa would really want in any circumstance, because it's already been decided to some degree.
So that really leads me to this whole notion of advanced directives and the importance of having those conversations about what your end of life wishes might be, even well before you might be terminally ill. What do you say about that?
Yeah, that's correct. And I'd like to point out that Central New York has a below average use of hospice services compared to the rest of the country. And it has been very difficult to budge those numbers, despite knowing that many people with not just cancer, but heart disease and emphysema and other conditions would benefit.
Why do you think that is? Do you think people fear that hospice care can actually somehow shorten life?
Yeah, I think that that is probably a big part of it. Because of the 6-month restriction by law, people assume that once they enter into hospice,
they're
doomed, when in fact we actually discharge several patients every month because they've improved or their prognosis looks like it's going to be years. That's pretty standard.
I think that's a very important fact, because mm-hmm. I think that's clearly a misconception.
Right. Yeah.
And many patients, we've been talking about 6 months, but many patients have been in the program for much longer than six
sure.
months.
Sure, yeah. So. And we have people that have been over a year. We have medical criteria that we have to use to justify keeping them in the program, because it is rich with benefits.
What are some other reasons why you think people don't? Do you think they fail to realize the severity of their illness, or do you think there's denial in place?
I think that there are many vectors pushing people to not recognize this. First of all, nobody wants to believe that somebody they love is approaching the end of their life. Our medical system is not particularly interested in bringing up difficult conversations. It takes a great deal of time. And it's a lot easier to do what people have been doing for many years, even though as people get sicker with many of these chronic conditions, what used to work with hospitalization and medication years ago begins to work less and less, if not at all, and becomes more detrimental. So it becomes easy for providers and families to not face these issues and not question these. And actually, these conversations really have to occur before hospice. Yeah.
And in some cases, I know that there's been a push to have people address these issues well before even illness strikes.
That's right.
Yes.
The whole idea.
That's right.
Well, tell us about the glossary of terms or the variety of papers that you need in place.
Well, there's been many because of legislation that started back decades, so there's many duplicative things, but the overall umbrella is called advanced directives. I think it's important to recognize that because of the relative lack of conversations in this area, New York State did pass laws a few years ago that are not widely
adhered to,
I would say, that physicians and facilities and providers are supposed to make sure they review all options, including palliative care options and refusal of treatments, so that people have the full understanding both of treatment, aggressively, or decision to pursue comfort care under hospice services. And by law, everybody who enters a hospital or is dealing with serious illness is supposed to receive this information.
So that they, and just to kind of confirm what Bill was alluding to before, that there's less stress if these conversations have taken place and somewhere the person's wishes are recorded, then at the time of the end of life or the period leading up to end of life, there's less uncertainty and less stress. And if they were willing to take on something like hospice, it's already known to be.
The medical landscape has changed over the last 50 years, and we're more complex, and there's more things going on now when it comes to medicine. So that's why it's important to have these issues up front.
I agree. How does somebody reach hospice? I mean, what's the, very quickly in a little bit of time
by law,
we have left.
Anyone can initiate a referral to hospice by calling our number at 634-1100. Family members can inquire with no obligation. We go out and do many information visits and often don't enroll people right away, if ever. I think that your caregivers in the audience need to think about hospice if they're finding that their parents are now nearly bedbound, living bed to chair, and going back and forth to the hospital with little benefit.
Well, I think such important information. Thank you so very much for coming in. We'll have a link to your website on our website, healthlinkonair.org. That's all one word. And I want to thank you for coming in. My guests have been Dr. Judy Settler, the medical director, and Bill Fowell, the communications officer for Hospice of Central New York. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
This is Deirdre Nealon, editor of The Healing Muse, with this week's selection. Poet Louisa Villani from New Jersey creates a poignant portrait of how mental illness traps not only the person who suffers from it, but also the family. Her poem, The Proper Use of Spells, is an incantation spoken by a daughter who is trying to get her father to a hospital. The Proper Use of Spells. The terrible thing is that I understand the voices, though I myself have never had the luxury of losing my mind. I assume losing one's mind is like a faith fall, a folding of the arms. The mind folds in, and all good reason collapses, like a beach umbrella closing for the season. I watch it go, with its tattered valise trailing the same pair of nylons for miles. My father never doubted I would catch him, so he fell off his meds, again. As his serotonin levels fell, the danger creature in him rose like a glass bubble from the primordial ooze and wore him like a skin. This incantation I call the Saint's Patience Hymn, or the Caring Daughter Ditty. It begins with the staccato knock of knuckles on a door, very reminiscent of a conductor's baton. When danger creature rises, it wants what it wants when it wants it, like a piece of pie at 2 a.m. So it knocks on your bedroom door. It knocks and it knocks till you rise in your sweatpants and you go to an all-night diner where the brown laminate table wears a patina of tiny scratches. Everything here is dulled the way creature likes it, fogged by something that can never be wiped away. Watch the waitress's arm back and forth. That rhythm. Begin your line. Here comes the coffee, pie, French fries, and maybe a bloody steak, but no cigarettes. The machine is out here, Dad. Keep talking. Television or weather. The spell of be here now. In the moment, you see the countless random impacts required to create the table's film. You see the need to change the name of the 5150 psychiatric hold to the 5050. Because those really are the odds. You see the need to keep creature listening. These are lovely menus, don't you think? So you can track his movements. You rub the talisman in your pocket, a fragment of mirror you stole from the hospital where you were born, and you move to the negotiations. Good behavior for a strawberry shake, not crying in public for more chocolate silk. Sugar is good. Feed the starving brain. But no, we can't get cigarettes now. All the stores are closed. Don't argue. When he comments on the beauty school student in the corner with her books and mannequin head, she is black and the mannequin is white, and he wants to do something about that. The spell of you are right. You are always right. Wouldn't you like a witness? use the urgency of the helicopter's gunmetal whir to bend him into the car. After all, this is Los Angeles, and there is a need for spotlights and for mirrors and for a little smoke. They have your brand in that machine near the hospital. It's not so much a herding as it is a shepherding, as in the Lord is my, which you secretly intone all the way there.
For joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us next week when we take a closer look at the psychiatric needs of cancer patients, plus the newest birth control options for young women. And we'll learn all about Upstate's new neuroscience research building and the exciting projects taking place there. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.